So I'm going to be talking about some work that I've been doing for my thesis with Partha Mitra and working in Richard Anson's lab. And Richard gave a talk here not so long ago. And so I'll be recapitulating some of the things he spoke about, but not with an emphasis on prosthetics. Although there is an application of some of this work that he's exploring in his lab to prosthetics. What I'll be discussing is the nature of the temporal structure that we see in a multiplicity of areas in the parietal lobe. And I'll be selecting for emphasis the kind of temporal structure which people have called gamma band temporal structure. I'll be emphasizing the analysis of this activity because it has quite sort of detailed metric. We have a lot of metrics that we can use to characterize this activity, and not all cells do this, but a significant fraction of cells do this in these areas. So this is sort of a distillation of analysis of about 500 to 600 cells in about 8 monkeys across 3 different brain areas, and upwards of 30 to 40% of cells you record in these experiments show this kind of activity. So I just thought I'd start out by saying that, because you won't be seeing a lot of population analyses, although I will be showing some. So a real emphasis in the work that I've been doing has been on statistical issues and the application of statistical measures to experimental data. And as part of that, you can then build stochastic process models which fit those statistical measures. So the way I'll be approaching this is just going over some of the statistical issues and then really focusing on the data. The story about what kinds of models can explain the measures we make of the activity is incomplete, and this is the kind of thing which requires more work. Because of that, I have some ideas, and I'll give you a flavor of those ideas. But I really want to say that I'd like you to think about this as well, if it interests you. We have a lot of metrics, as I've already said, on the data, and it shows us a lot of models which do not fit the data. It'd be interesting to know what kind of models do fit the data. And also, it's not just a model-fitting exercise in the sense that we can always write down some kind of mathematical description, but really we're interested in models which could be biologically or biophysically plausible. So temporal structure, this is sort of just a very sort of general introductory slide. It's just there's sort of cellular and network properties which it reflects, and I like to sort of keep them distinct in my mind. The emphasis with work with behaving animals is, of course, the relationship of the temporal structure to the behavior. You wouldn't record from a behaving animal unless you were trying to understand how the dynamics of the neural activity reflected in some sense the processing that underlie the behavior. So we'll spend a lot of effort to try and establish a relationship to changes in temporal structure and changes in behavior. And there's always an interest in mechanism. It's very hard to do mechanism in a behaving animal, but it's at least worth trying. And this is where the models come in. And the real emphasis is on the stochastic nature of neural activity. You don't get the same response each time you go through the same sequence of movements or same sequence of states, mental states, let's say, generally. And the reason for this is that neural activity is stochastic. And this needs to be sort of kept in mind. So we're going to be using spectral analysis to analyze the temporal structure and neural activity. And I'll just go over the basic quantities. Neural activity is most traditionally viewed as just a sequence of spike times. You have a bunch of neurons that are firing action potentials. Our view is to take a slightly more, and it's not a particularly new one, but it's important to what we do, so I should emphasize it, to consider the extracellular potential as a important measure of neural activity, as well as just the sequence of spike times. And so this voltage is a continuous process. It has a value of the voltage at each point in time, while the sequence of spike times is a discrete sequence of events, and there may be long periods of time when there are no events, in which case you have no data. you could say. I'll also be emphasizing an alternative representation of spiking activity, the point process, but it's equivalent and complementary to the sequence of spike times, and it's a sequence of interspike intervals. And it's actually quite a useful extension to the analysis of a temporal structure, is to consider not just the spike times, but the sequence of intervals between them. So now we're talking about another continuous variable. You can have interspike intervals of anything that are of any duration. And at each point in this sequence, you can you get a value for that interval length, as opposed to spike times, where sometimes you will get no spikes. You'll always get a value for the interspike interval. So these two are both continuous processes. Do we have a pointer that I could gesture with? Let me just... Okay, so yeah, so these, this value, this quantity and this quantity are both continuous processes. This quantity is a point process.
But the eyes are continuous, don't they go up and then crash?
You mean continuous valued?
Continuous valued, and as such can be viewed in the mathematical sense as a continuous process.
But with steps in time.
Time is not explicitly represented in this process, and that's actually, that will come through. So this is not a continuous process in time. It's a continuous process in index number.
But then T something is also a continuous process.
It's
not stationary.
Continuous over a discrete set. I mean, if you're going to allow index number as the variable,
well, so these are both representations of the same process, and the process is a point process. It's a sequence of events. But what I mean to say is that this representation can be treated as though the process were a continuous process. So a voltage that fluctuates in time is obviously a continuous process. This is a point process representation that can be treated as though it were a continuous process. Well, you cannot treat the sequence of spike times as a continuous process. Time is explicit. So maybe when we go down to the analysis of these quantities, it may become slightly clearer. It's an important point.
T always grows and tau can go up and down. That's
T, as T grows, you either get an event or you don't get an event. So let's use an alternative description.
Tn is a set of increasing numbers.
Okay, so this is maybe one way. So a better way to express this would be that this representation is a counting representation. You count how many events occurred in an interval in time. While this representation is an interval representation, you just simply measure the length of the interval since the last event. The counting representation is zero or one. You either have an event or you don't in each point in time, and as such is not continuous.
Our confusion is that you have written T of n, whereas you really mean n of T.
Exactly. So the counting process, which is what we'll get down to here, but the counting process is dn of T, where you get an incremental value of the well, this is x of tau.
So the continuous variable versus the discrete variable.
Yes.
Which is what you said earlier.
Yes.
Okay.
So these are the basic quantities. When we're interested in analyzing the temporal structure, we're really interested in the correlations in time or in the index of interest. And we use spectral analysis to estimate these quantities. So just to briefly recapitulate, the spectrum is a Fourier transform of the correlation function, and they both measure the same information. The key benefit of spectral measures is that they have better statistical properties than correlation function estimates. In particular, the error bars are much tighter for the same amount of data. You need an order of magnitude more data to estimate a correlation function than you do a spectrum. And when you're dealing with activity from a behaving animal, this is a really important issue because you don't have large amounts of data. You can only hold a cell for upwards of an hour, let's say, if you're doing well. and the animal then has to perform a trial, multiple trials, and you're only interested in a part of the trial. So data limitations are important, and the spectrum helps you deal with that. So the basic quantity in any spectral analysis is the Fourier transform of the data. So here's the X is now the Fourier transform of the field potential, the voltage, the LFP, and you have some sampling interval, some frequency variable, and then you also have a data taper, which is important to being able to estimate these effectively. This is just an inner product with some basis vector.
Pisha, once you've estimated the spectrum and then you inverse Fourier transform, you get a correlation function?
Yes, you can do that. But the error bars will not be local for the correlation function, while they will be local for the spectrum. So basically what this is a reflection of is the fact that if you have a lot of uncertainty at one frequency, you're not sampled well at some time scale, then you will introduce errors across all time in the correlation function. And that's a problem, and you can only deal with that by collecting more data.
So what does index K stand
for? Index K refers to the index of the basis vector, so there could be multiple basis vectors. So there's some space into which you're projecting your time series.
It's not just Fourier.
It's not just a Fourier transform, no. So for statistical reasons, you don't have this as being constant with doing just one vector. You can actually construct a subspace with multiple dimensions into which you can project your signal and then do smoothing. So these are just statistical operations. And
so Fourier value called spectral?
Well, this is a Fourier transform. It's a windowed Fourier transform.
So W has a special form?
Yes, so I can, yes, it has a special shape. It's basically, doesn't have edges. If you were constant in the window, then you'd have to have an edge at the end of the window to go to zero, because you don't have infinite amount of time to observe your signal. So this is a direct consequence of you observing the signal for some short period of time. You smooth out the edges. So then you can, for the counting process, the sequence of spike times. K refers to, so you're dealing with the same piece of data, and you're projecting it through a different basis function.
But
that's orthogonal to the first.
Different way of moving.
Yes. So you have the first function. Well, I should just show you what they look like. I wasn't meaning to get involved in this, but I should do it.
Cosine is
square,
cosine is cube.
You'll see. Okay. Whoops. Okay, so let's not get into all that business. But here's a family of them. So they apply to the same interval in time, and they're orthogonal to each other. And the first one has no modes.
So it's not just smoothing the edges.
Well, their basic property is to smooth the edges. They come down. But when you have multiple of them, you can be more. You have more freedom in how you smooth the edge. You have these reflect multiple projections.
Each color is one of the W's?
Yes.
And what's the annoying blue blurry line? It's driving me crazy.
I can't see that line.
So why is it smoothing the edges?
Because the function extends in time outside of this window. And if you were to just have a constant value, then it would have a large edge at the end, the outside the window, be zero outside the window.
I understand, but it has also some modulation inside the window. So
yeah.
It's just cutting, just changing the function itself.
Intuitively, what it's doing is it's smoothing out the ripples in the these are. So you don't think.
The
so these are this is. It's well, it's orthogonal to the first.
Cannot relate what I see and what I hear. That's my problem.
So you don't believe that it. You're not convinced that it's smoothing.
Probably it is something. No, that I'm not convinced. I just don't see it. You say you're just smoothing the edges. So I was.
Well, you're not just okay. Okay.
Almost constant and then smoothing the edges. Maybe I see something which is
So you have to, so this is, there's a whole set of properties to these functions, and their basic property is to smooth the data. The way they do that is more complicated than just smoothing the edges. So the way that they smooth the data is that they project the signal into a frequency band. They reject all the signal out of the band, and it turns out, this is just a reflection of some uncertainty principle, that you can get multiple tapers that will, multiple projection operator, multiple basis vectors that allow you to reject the signal out of band for a given bandwidth. These are the shapes of those functions. The reason why this one, for example, has an edge is because it doesn't project into the band as well as this one does. This is the smoothest taper, you could say, and this is the next most smooth. It has a node in it, and it's orthogonal to the first. I'm sorry for, I guess, being too casual in my use of the word smooth, but...
So how did you arrive at this
function? I didn't arrive at this function. It was derived by David Thompson at Bell Labs, and the way you do it is you solve an integral equation where you define the concentration in frequency of each one of these sequences, and then you optimize that concentration given the length of the sequence and the range over which you define, you know, the bandwidth. So there's an integral equation, and you have a series of solutions to that integral equation, and these are those
so
solutions.
So each of these colors corresponds to a given K?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So we can step through them just to see how they ripple out. And we use those in estimating the spectral properties of the data. So there's the spectrum,
you
there's
use
the...
all of them at once?
You combine them. You take some combination. Linear combination.
You say this is better than just Fourier.
Absolutely. And the reason for that is because the Fourier transform itself with a constant window has large side lobes. It's not concentrated in frequency very well. It has a 1 over F squared fall off, which is not very good.
Edges.
Because of the, yes, because of the edge.
Okay, so
that's the first thing.
Why you may want to smooth the edges.
Right.
Why do you want to put some modulation in the middle?
So the reason for that is different. So the first reason is that the bias is introduced by, which is the bias of the signal, your estimate is introduced by having this 1 over f squared from other frequencies. So you want to have that cut off as much as you can. The second reason, the reason for having multiple of these is to reduce the variance. So the variance now is the change in the estimate as you move a small amount in frequency.
Uh-huh.
And if you only have one quantity, your variance will be large. If you average multiple quantities, you're effectively increasing, you are increasing the number of degrees of freedom of your estimate, and as such, reducing the variance by 1 over
you
the number.
About some random functions which you want to...
Yeah, so you have some stochastic, realization of a stochastic process which you are now estimating the spectrum of, the correlations in.
And this is in some sense optimal for any ensemble of functions which you want
to... It needs to be a stationary process. And the it needs to be a stationary process, and the properties of the estimators are known for Gaussian processes. But sure, you could construct some pathological function, but it also applies to point processes as well as continuous Gaussian processes. So it's pretty general, and we'll, you know.
So these tapers were derived assuming Gaussian noise.
The tapers are not derived assuming Gaussian noise. The properties of the estimators that you get from applying those tapers to the spectrum, that derives from the Gaussian process assumption. But that just means to say that the fact that they saturate the Kramer-Rao bound is a result of it being a Gaussian process. It may not saturate the Kramer-Rao bound if it's not a Gaussian process, but it doesn't mean to say that it's still better than the estimate you would get without having multiple tapers and with tapers that didn't have this smooth side. So it gets kind of involved, but so I hope that answers some of your questions. So this is the multi-taper sort of techniques. Each one of these is a taper and there's multiple of them. Okay, so so that's what that's what the W is reflecting, is the application of multiple of these tapers, and each one of your projections is indexed by K. So you get multiple projections at a given frequency of your data through the tapers. The same operation, so this is now in, this is in time, the same operation can be applied to the sequence of delta functions in time for the spikes. And you get, we just use a different, I mean, this is just, you just throw a bunch of delta functions in and you get this reduction. And
so you have a delta function exponent?
Yes. So, this, so now I'm just indexing over the sum of I'm summing over the delta functions instead of summing over time. And there you have the projection into frequency in the same way that you had for the field potential.
Are there time intervals missing the upper one? I mean, are you taking inner product over time of WK with XT times that?
Yes.
Okay, so if there had been an integral sign.
The integral would be here.
Right, then that integral sign would disappear and show up as evaluation of time t.
Oh, for this expression, yes, that's right. So there's a sum over time here. So I mean, we could rewrite it with the delta functions, and but do you see what's happening?
Right.
Yeah, I already got rid of them. So I should, put the integral over time at the front and put the delta functions in the front here, and then you'll now have a sequence of delta functions.
So what's delta t?
Delta t is your sampling interval. So that comes into the Fourier transform, because you're this is a discrete version of the Fourier transform. I could have a continuous version of the Fourier transform where delta t would disappear.
So the units are f is 1 over t, t is 1 over
t. F times
t is measured.
T has no, so yeah, t is an index. Yeah, t is an n. Excuse me. Yeah, that's quite right. So I should, if I were being rigorous, I should have n delta t is t. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's quite right. So those are the so we call this this is the spectrum of the field potential. This is the spectrum of the spike train, and then we can construct another spectrum of the intervals between the sequence of intervals, and call this the interval spectrum. And so this is again just the spectrum of the sequence of spike intervals, and provides you with new information that's not present if you take the spectrum of the sequences of spikes, and we'll go into that in some more detail. So here are the spectra that you get. They're just averages over the square of the projections. And the averages are over some ensemble. The ensemble is defined by K, which is the sequence of the family of projection basis vectors that you use to project your signal. You can also, in the case of repeated trials, you can also include in this your ensemble of trials. So you're just averaging across trials. There's another quantity which is useful, and I'll be talking about, and this is the coherency between two signals. So these are univariate quantities. You just have the spike train in its and the complex conjugate projection squared. Here you can take the relationship between the spike train and the field potential. And you normalize by the amount of energy in each individual process, and this normalization results in a complex number between 0 and 1, magnitude between 0 and 1, and it measures the linear relationship between the two individual processes. So I can, for example, construct a function of the field potential which would predict the events in the spike train, and the magnitude of this complex number tells me how well I can do that, and the phase gives you different information about the relationship between the two processes.
So averaging includes summation over K?
That's right. So this averaging includes summation over K, the ensemble.
the same weight, or is it?
Doesn't need to. It makes the analytics more easy for putting error bars in, but or the calculation for putting error bars in, but it doesn't need to be equal weight.
What's the relation between coherency and cross-correlation?
The coherency is used in instead of the cross-correlation, which is traditionally used to measure the relationship between two different processes. So in the same way that the spectrum is the Fourier transform of the correlation function, the cross spectrum, which is the numerator of this expression, is the Fourier transform of the cross correlation function. The reason why we prefer the coherency over the cross correlation function is twofold. One, the statistical properties are better because you know in the frequency domain and for a stationary process there are these reasons for the error bars being tighter, so you can resolve signals more easily. The other reason is because this is normalized. The cross-correlation function isn't normalized. You can try to normalize it, but your normalization will always be dependent on some ad hoc quantity such as some time scale. You're smoothing over the central bin, but it's not a principled or it's subject to a time scale. This normalization is done independently for different frequencies and can be done at all timescales in the same way. And this has obvious advantages. You now have a normalized quantity which you can compare between different sites, between different recordings, at the same site, across trials. I mean, it's a much more powerful tool. So not only is it better at resolving signals, it's more useful when resolving signals. And it's nice that you can use it to measure relationships between point and continuous processes in this way. So this is kind of in the wrong place, but this is this story about the multi-taper analysis, which I brought up earlier. So the basic quantity is the time frequency plane. You're dealing with a potentially non-stationary process, which is evolving in time and has some frequency content that you want to characterize. And you're basically windowing some region in time and characterizing the properties of the signal in this tile and then moving your window across in time and frequency. And as I said before, you've got multiple orthogonal tapers for each of these tiles. And since they're orthogonal, you're able to combine them and add new information from each of them. And they have this property of reducing the bias and improving the bias and reducing the bias and the variance. And this is good to.
So when you do an experiment, you do it for some interval t. I mean, let me take it back. When you do an experiment, typically you show some kind of stimulus and you look at some interval t of seconds, say, and you do this over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So the window there is not a whole second. The window would be windows you slide across here, and each window has its own set of tapers. Okay.
Exactly. So this is really useful to analyzing activity in a behaving animal because you really are interested in how things are changing in time, and you can't just average across the whole trial, which is what people often do when they're trying to estimate the correlations in their data. And you get all the problems of changing firing rates and all kinds of other issues, which we don't have to worry about at all. At least we don't worry about it, we just deal with it. And then this issue, it's a crucial issue, that the data is hardly plentiful in these recordings. It's very difficult to record from individual neurons in a monkey that's doing something. So I just wanted to relate this to models. These are not the usual models that people talk about when studying the brain or neural activity. These are stochastic process models, statistical models, and the measurements of the spectrum and the interval spectrum directly test what kinds of models can fit the data. So let's recapitulate what these models are. Basically familiar to most people, all people, I expect. So the Poisson process is the most elementary stochastic point process. It's characterized by one quantity, the mean firing rate, or the intensity, and it has a flat spectrum and a flat interval spectrum. So I just wanted to.
The Poisson with the constant rate, or this can include the Poisson with independent.
So the most elementary is Poisson with a constant rate. You can, that's called a homogeneous Poisson process. You can extend the Poisson process to that this process to a time-varying rate in two different ways.
So then it will not be flat.
Right. So when you have rate variations, you will introduce changes, and I'll go over what those changes are.
You can just spike in the rise, and then goes down.
Okay. So let me right. So this is one with a refractory period in it. It's a minor detail, but it's kind of important when considering neural activity. You'll see it doesn't actually change anything, and there's a whole zoology of what goes onto your spectrum when you do things like that. But the basic thing is that it falls off exponentially, the spike interval histogram, and you're quite right that it should go up at the origin. The spectrum and the interval spectrum are flat, so I've generated 10 trials of that data with a firing rate of, I think, 30 hertz, but it's not. That just gives you a reasonable amount of data to estimate these quantities on. And you see that the spectrum is flat and it's constant at some non-zero value. So what I've done is I've normalized out the rate. So it turns out that the spectrum for a sequence of delta functions which are uncorrelated is simply just a constant at the sum of the number of delta functions. I guess that makes sense. Every time you add a delta function, you add uncorrelated energy across the whole spectrum. You just raise the spectrum up one. The interval spectrum is uncorrelated because the interval spectrum is flat because the intervals are uncorrelated. This is the same kind of idea. This is normalized by the variance in the intervals.
How long was the time series? How much data did
you? 1 second. About half a second, I mean, it's...
30 hertz, and these are estimates are from recitations, or...?
These estimates are from 300 spikes.
No, but only from one spike trend, or from...
It actually doesn't make any difference, basically. It doesn't make any difference.
Error bar, I'm just asking for...
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that what you're interested in to estimate the size of the error bar is the number of spikes. That's the amount of data which is reflected in the size of the error bar. So you can take a train of 30 seconds and, 10 seconds, 10 trials of 1 second, with a firing rate that's constant, you get 300 spikes. Or you could take 10 pieces of 1 second.
The only this is from one trial or from several?
This is average across several trials, but the important quantity is the number of spikes. It's average across several trials.
About how many trials?
10. 10 1 second. Long intervals.
If you have one second long interval, you can actually put error bars on it?
Yes. If the firing rate is 30 hertz, you're going to get terrible error bars, but you can certainly do it. In experience, depending on your signal to noise, you can get structure in your spectrum with 100 spikes. If you've got a heavily bursting process, all the spikes are arriving in pairs, then you can do it with 50. But the error bars are not going to be great with that few number of spikes. So that's the Poisson process. Oh, so I should actually answer your point. So if you have a rate variation in a Poisson process, you can only introduce one kind of change to the spectrum. What happens is that, so the interval spectrum isn't affected by it. The spectrum will get raised above the constant level. You'll never get any dips below the constant level. And the way you can think about that is that as you change the rate, you increase so a Poisson process is dispersed in the sense that the spikes don't sort of cluster or they're not regular in any sense. If you increase the rate, you basically introduce a small cluster of larger, more spikes, and then it goes down again. For analyzing that sequence, it just looks like there's some sort of bunching together of the spikes, and bunching together increases energy at some frequency. So it always goes up. The only way to get a suppression in the spectrum is to introduce some repulsion with the other spikes, and you can't do that with a Poisson process, because the Poisson process is completely independent of all the events in the process. So you can increase the number of spikes and throw them down randomly. That increases the dispersion, but you can't. The amount of energy raises the level of the spectrum. If you want to reduce, if you want to suppress the level of the spectrum, you have to throw in some explicit dependence with the other elements in the process, and you just can't do that with the Poisson process. The way you do that in the simplest way is to do it with a renewal process. So a renewal process is one where you're renewing each realization of the process is drawn from the same density of interspike intervals. And it's characterized just by the time to the next spike. So you're renewing every spike, and then you reset some quantity, and then you integrate up some variable, and then you have an event, and you reset. So this is an integrate and fry neuron with a constant memory potential. Stochastic threshold is a renewal process. And it has an arbitrary spectrum, as I said. So here I've generated one with a gamma distribution of interspike intervals, order 3. So this is kind of a refractory period. People call you don't tend to get spikes when you just had a spike. And it's got a lot. It's got some kind of a tail, so it's still somewhat disorderly. You can see the spectrum is basically flat, apart from this suppression at low frequencies. And this relates to the fact that you've got this repulsion. When I just had a spike, I can't get another spike. So easily.
Doesn't this suppress high frequencies?
It turns out that it doesn't, because every spike introduces more high frequencies, and these spikes are arriving in this uncorrelated fashion. So the high frequencies are not suppressed. It's the low frequencies that are suppressed. And you can think about this as imagining the correlation function for this kind of process has a low probability of firing, and then it comes back up again. And then it's basically flat. There's no interactions at long times, which is what this tail is doing. And if you take the Fourier transform of 1 minus the Gaussian, you're going to get 1 minus the Gaussian.
So another way to think about it is refraction period actually makes the spike frame more regular?
Yes.
And gets rid of long time fluctuations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And but the interval spectrum is still flat. There's still no correlations between the different intervals in the process. And you can see that it's just a constant. So that's sort of a background. So what I'll be doing is I'll be going over these quantities and showing you what cortical spiking data looks like in the parietal lobe. I'll be focusing on three regions. So this is a slide I stole from Richard. We're looking at this is the macaque brain, and this is the intraparietal sulcus, and we've got the lateral bank and the medial bank. Giving activity before saccades reaches, and then there's another area which isn't explicitly marked on here, but it's basically nearby, which is for motion perception. And the data I'll be discussing were collected in Richard's lab, and there's also data that I downloaded off the internet, which was collected in Bill Newsom's lab, and I'll be going into the properties of each of those data sets. So I should emphasize that the activity in the reaching area was published and analyzed by... So what I'm presenting is new analysis of previously published data. As well as in LIP, it's not been published yet. So here's the different tasks. So the memory saccade task is being used for every LIP, so I should go over the tasks. I'm not going to be spending any more time on them. What's happening in the memory saccade task is the animal's fixating, so it's an eye movement task. The animal saccade is a ballistic eye movement. You fixate on a point in space, which is cued, which is marked by a light in a dark room. The animal fixates, and then there's a cue flashed in some peripheral location, which the animal has to remember where it is. Then sits again in the dark room, remembering where this cue was presented. And then when the fixation light goes out, you know, in a dark room, and the animal moves their eyes to where they remember the cue to have been. And once they perform the saccade, they get this reward if it's accurate. And so what people have found is the firing rate in the LIP varies during the visual memory and the saccadic epochs of the trial in a spatially tuned fashion, so that you can, in some sense, predict where the animal will move their eyes based on the firing rate of the neural of the spikes. I'll jump down to the memory reach task. It's basically the same for reaches, but you just have to control eye movements, it turns out, in the reach region. Oh, no, this is widespread. So there's a frontal eye fields, superior cortical. I mean, there's a lot of areas which become active during hold periods. Basal ganglia.
You can predict
where those are. Yeah, no, this is part of a large network, a distributed network in cortex and subcortical as well. So during the... during the reach task, it's the same thing. So you fixate because you have to control eye movements to get the tuning in this area. But the you touch here or you touch in the center of the screen, and then they get a spatial cue, and then they move their arm to the where the cue was, and they're trained to do this without moving their eyes, which is, I guess, takes some time. But basically, this is what the animal's doing. So these are the two the eye movement and reach related tasks. And I'll be analyzing in particular the data during the hold period where they've had the cue. They know where they're going to have to move their arm or their eyes, but they're just waiting to get the go signal, the dimming of the fixation light. And this is the period where you get these elevated firing rates that are, for the most part, relatively constant, although you certainly get ramping up and ramping down. So then the other activity. Oh, and I'll be presenting spikes and fields. Well, so the other task, let's do the task first. So this is a classic work done 10 years ago almost now. It was in Bill Newsom's lab by Ken Britton, Mike Shadlin, and analyzed in some detail by Wyeth Baer, who's published this data on the internet and on his website. And he's actually studied the power spectrum and basically characterized the power spectral properties of activity in MT. What I've added is just this interval spectrum, which I'll show you. And the task is a visual motion discrimination task. So they were very interested in coding questions, which I won't get into, what they had the animal do, but because it was really quite heavily addressed by the study. What they had the animal do was report the perception of motion in some noisy display. So I'll only be considering activity where there's no noise. So basically you look and fixate, and then you present moving dots in some part of the screen, and which is tuned to the activity of the response of the cell. And if the motion's in one direction, the animal has to look to the right, and if the motion's in the other direction, it has to look in the opposite direction. And they present this motion for 2 seconds, and the data I'll be analyzing is only in that 2 second period. There's no baseline activity that I'll be considering or subsequent activity. So it's a visual stimulus period. So here's the, that's right. So the experimental data, so spikes and fields are recorded in this experiment. But only spikes have been recorded in these other two experiments. So I'll go into the spikes and fields analysis first. It's somewhat more involved than just the spikes. And then I'll move on to these other areas. An important thing, I guess, that I want to emphasize is that you learn a lot when you record the fields as well as the spikes. And we'll, the reason for that is because there is some relationship between the field potential, at least in this experiment there is, and it's been shown in other experiments as well. There is a relationship between the phase of an oscillation or some local in frequency structure in the field potential and the arrival time of the spikes. And so this is one trial. The cue comes on here. There's 1 second before the cue. The cue's flashed for 100 milliseconds. And there's another period of hold, a second. And then the fixation light dims and the animal moves their eyes. And so here's the extracellular potential, a sample of 20 kilohertz out to 10 kilohertz. And you can see clearly lots of action potentials arrive after the presentation of this cue, and they go off after the animal moves their eyes, and this is the sort of classic delay period activity. And if you go and look at the traces, this is kind of maybe if I just zoom in a little bit more, you'd see it better. But basically, it's noisy. I mean, let's not avoid that fact. But you basically see lots of bursting. I mean, lots of action potentials arrive very closely together. This is quite an active recording. Many cells can be heard, but only one was isolated cleanly. And you see these ripples and spikes arriving on the ripples. That's basically what these little ripples are. But I'll be characterizing those signals. So what we did was first to look at the spectrum of the field potential. So we filter out the spikes explicitly, and then with a low-pass filter to get rid of all the high-frequency signals. And we compare the activity during the baseline and working memory. And so here we have frequency out to 200 hertz, and we have power on a log scale. And we've got error bars. And this is an average across data from two monkeys. So you basically see this sort of nice roll-off above about 20 hertz, and you see this sort of bumpish activity at low frequencies. EEG signals are known to have very low frequency signals in them. When you go to the working, when you go to this this period when the animal's holding this cue in memory, and you only consider the direction to which the firing rate is high, and not the direction the other directions, and you average across all of the activity, you actually see this little bump that appears, and it's significantly different from the spectrum in the baseline, which is shown here with the dashed line, the error bars are showing with dots, and it's actually significantly different only in the 25 to 90 hertz region. So it's rather broadband. But it's certainly local in frequency. There's no significant difference between the. It's slightly raised, this is true, but it's not significantly different as it is in this other region. And I can go into why you see it slightly raised, but this is kind of like a more technical issue or detailed issue. The basic phenomenon is you get this bump in the gamma band, so-called gamma band 25 to 90 hertz. And just to sort of show you it across, just show you a little bit more detail. If we take the power at low frequency in each recording and plot the distribution of that power and compare it with the power in the gamma band divided by the baseline power, so we're looking at changes in power. These are the two distributions, median and then plus and minus 25 percentiles. And this shows you, so there's a shift in the population that's not overlapping. And you can see what the signals look like in the spectrum, the ratio between the spectrum. So basically there's a bump that gets bigger as you go down this distribution, which is what you would expect. But it's quite well represented. You don't have to have spike trains, isolated cells in the recording. If you were to just record from another site that doesn't contain much spiking, you still see the same structures. And this shows you how it evolves in time. David Kleinfeld asked me not to show too many pretty color pictures, so this is, I think, the only one. But
I was in one color picture for that.
He wanted to see more black lines on white backgrounds, so I tried to please. Well, anyway, you will be seeing a lot of black lines on white backgrounds, so you can see the shape of the function. So you consider the preferred.
He's also in this book.
Oh no, I don't need to listen to what he says, but well, anyway. He invited me, right? So here we have a spectrogram. So this is this time frequency plane. And we've got single sites and then population across the two monkeys. And now we're showing the preferred activity. The cue comes on at the first dotted line, dashed line, and the saccade happens at the second dashed line. And in the anti-preferred direction, it's not there. And this is quite pronounced. It doesn't take much to convince yourself that there's a difference between the left and the right panels. And if you look across the population, you can see it too. And these field potentials really do contain quite precise information about the state of the animal. I guess this is supposed to convince you of that. There's also stuff at low frequencies that I won't get into, but the gamma band in the field potential is quite significant.
So this is not the ratio of?
No. This is tracking along in time. Right? The ratio was done for testing for differences between one condition and the next. Now I'm just showing you the signal evolving in time. So the baseline will be taken from this.
But in the spectrum we showed there was, actually I didn't see a bump. It had the shoulder or something.
Right.
But here the power seems to go down and up again. So
this guy, were you referring to this?
Yeah.
That's 60 hertz. So when the energy of the signal is low, so we now have a slightly more sophisticated system which has got better noise properties, but in this recording, you can see the 60 hertz. When the signal is low in energy, you see it popping up. And then when the signal comes up, when the neural activity gets more loud, you can't see it anymore.
You mean
this thing? Sorry, I don't have a better way to say.
So if I go from below to above,
yes.
From bottom to top, it's red, then yellow, then red, then yellow. So there's something
red,
going down
then,
and
so
going up again, right?
I need to go more slowly because I don't know what you're talking about.
During the period, after the
yellow,
yeah.
Red, yellow.
Yeah, and there was no such bump in the spectrum you showed.
That's what I was trying to emphasize, that there was this bump in the spectrum. I'll do it again. No, this is fine, So, so here it is. So this is red, yellow, red, yellow. This is a population average over, a lot of recordings.
It goes down all the time, should be yellow, green, blue.
Okay, look, please, we can understand this, okay? Let's go to the population average spectrum. Okay. Red, yellow, slightly less yellow. This is why I'm not showing you lots of color pictures, because David said that people can't see the shape of the function. If you take a cut through this figure, you will get, this is exactly how I generated the figure, right? You will get this.
This is
a cut during 500 milliseconds of activity toward the end of the memory period. It's very localized in time. So this is average across many sites.
Second is not so localized.
Sorry, I didn't want to say that it was average across the whole trial. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can certainly go less than that if we want to be fussy about such things. I'm glad you like to see the color figure, because I kind of like the color figure.
We look at between A and C.
A and C.
The question was about is that it seems that they're qualitatively different. And so the issue, so you said where you peeled back to your population average, and indeed there's
a I'm guilty of showing you a good example. It's not qualitatively different. It's not qualitatively different.
Well, it is, because there's a local...
No, the peak is just bigger. So if I were to whiten the process... Okay. Let's go back to the, because we can't discuss shapes of figures, shapes of functions.
Most
without.
Of them look like that, and one of them has a really big bump.
No. That's what this, okay, this is, this is supposed to convince you otherwise, right? The whole, the function, each one has a bump in it. It's just the bump gets bigger across the distribution. It's not that the weakest, one of the weakest examples doesn't have a bump. It just has a very small bump. Okay. The reason.
Yeah,
these are the different sites. These are different. No, that's not true. The reason is because spectra of field potentials roll off. So what you're seeing confounding this is this whole, this roll off. You see this edge? It's not an edge, sorry. Bad word. This roll off. If I were to divide this by this, sorry, if I were to divide this by this, then you would get rid of this roll off, and you'd see this bump.
Okay, so that's why.
Which is what these, all of, okay, can we agree that at least all of these contain some localized bump?
This is the ratio, but we want
this
to
is the
ratio.
That's, but there's a reason why I show the ratio. It's because it gets rid of this roll-off. It's called whitening.
But with the color, you don't show the ratio. You show the spectrum.
Okay. That's right. And so that's why you can't really see the bump. You can't really see the bump on the color scale.
The
bump is really big here. I mean, like, it's so big.
That one neuron that has a really big.
No, that's not true, because I have many recordings look like. We have 250 recordings of field potentials.
So some of them have this big bump and some of them.
Yeah, and I can even go farther than that. I can tell you that 25% have bumps this big.
So
or bigger.
Four of them have really big bumps.
And 50% have quite big bumps. And 75% have smaller bumps. We can measure the size of the bump.
But those are ratio bumps. None of those show up in the color block.
Well, you're never going to... No. I'm glad we're having fun. I mean, you know, like... I'm not sure...
So, Bijan, you need
what's the question?
To have the black and white version of these color blocks.
Do you want to see that? I mean, I have such things in other presentations, but I didn't want to... It's there. Okay, let's. We can measure the size of the bump. Okay, we've done decodes on how well can you decode the direction based on the size on the activity, and you know this provides you with a measure of the size of the bump. I don't want to get into such detailed issues at this point. Suffice to say that it can be done. I want to get into the relationship of this bump with the spikes, which is really where this is going.
As long as we tend to focus on unimportant details, so you get.
No. I'm afraid I'm never going to finish in half an hour. I've only gone through like 10% of my talk. Oh, yeah, it's spatially tuned. Okay, so this is the tuning in frequency in the different directions the animal goes to. Because I just showed you this bump and this region and this region. Now you can see the shape of the function. Here's the firing rate between 0 and 50 hertz on average, but you know you get some examples which are 100 hertz off the tail. This is what the spatial tuning of the field potential looks like, and if you go to low frequencies, it's no longer there. So if I take the signal at its largest value at, say, 10 hertz, where the spectrum has the most energy, you don't see spatial tuning, while you do see quite strong spatial tuning at higher frequencies when the signal's not so higher in energy, which is kind of important.
That's the cut direction?
Yes.
So the ratio between the right and the left cut at picture.
Yes, right, because I normalize, this is normalized by the baseline. So it's phase shift tuned. So now the spikes. So, ooh, this is in the wrong place. That was a mistake. You want more color? Well, okay. Let me just jump to this because I'm not going to have time to go through everything anyway. So here's a spike spectrum. So this is kind of what they look like when they have peaks in their gamma band. So the rate is divided out, and you've got frequency at 500 hertz, and you can see that there's this basically large shape to it, and then there's this sharp dip at low frequencies that creates a peak. This peak is at around 50 hertz, and it's in the so-called gamma band. And now we're discussing now the spectrum of a point process, which is quite different from the spectrum of sort of some sequences, some fluctuating continuous process, and requires a little bit more effort to understand. And I'm going to try and present some of our efforts to you, I guess. So this is what the interspike interval histogram looks like. For a neural process, you can derive the shape of the spectrum from the interspike interval spectrum. Interspike interval histogram. And it's been in previous work, it was suggested that you could basically understand changes in the spectrum by changes in the interspike interval histogram.
So is this in a neural process?
No.
This relation is not satisfied.
It's not a renewal process because the interval spectrum has some slope to it. It's not constant. And this is not the best example. I mean, I can, you know, we'll go into this. I'll show you, and you can decide for yourself.
As you said, you can analytically draw the spectrum you would expect from the interval.
I can show you those, right. So what you see basically is that, so let's look at this interspike interval histogram, and then we'll take this set to the spectrum. So what is it? Well, it has two prominent features. One is that there's this huge spike at very low time intervals, and that's bursting. Bursting happens a lot in LIP. And reported a lot in MT as well, 30%, 40%. It's actually close to 50% of the cells in some databases have bursts in them, yes.
Do you do spike sorting?
Yeah.
To see in refractory theory, you need to sort the spikes.
No, these are sorted. These are single units. Yeah. Actually, we made a lot of effort. One of the reasons why the database would be larger if we weren't so fussy about our spike sorting. But we want to have stable recordings over long periods of time. I mean, all these things are artifacts we want to get rid of.
Can you tell us just where the spike is on the time axis? What the range is for the cells that you saw? What's the X value?
So this is the interval.
Yes, I can't just read it because it's all the way over at the left.
100 milliseconds.
No.
Sorry.
Where the spike is occurring. That is
at short zero. Intervals. So what the last
value of the short intervals, roughly speaking.
3 milliseconds.
Okay, thanks.
It's very sharp. So we will get. So this is the first property is that it's got a bump. The second part is very sharp, and it's centered around 2 to 3 milliseconds.
And that's across different LIP neurons.
You see it repeatedly, but this is a single neuron.
I understand, but I'm saying across the populations.
This is an important property of LIP neurons is that they have very sharp peaks at low spike intervals around 2 to 3, maybe 4 milliseconds, but not much more.
2 to 4 milliseconds for bracket.
Yes.
Great. Thanks.
And then you see, it dipping down, and then you see a second bump. And the second bump sort of looks like a gamma function with some, you know, low order, say 4. I mean, we can play games and fit these things, but basically the point is that it has a long tail, and it rises up. And the combination of these two is present. It's bimodal. It's present when you get this shape. So let's decompose this a little bit more. If you were to just have a bursting process, and you were to throw those bursts down in a Poisson fashion without any correlations between them, then you would get a spectrum which rose up to 2 if every spike arrived in the burst, and some difference between 2 and 1 when a fraction of them arrive in the burst. At DC, it then rolls down and then rises back up again at the burst frequency, which is around 500 hertz in this case. It's very non-local in frequency because the bursts are defined as a period in time, 2 milliseconds in this case. And in fact, analytically, it's very simple to do, and you just get a cosine squared function for the spectrum if you have every spike arriving in a burst, and these bursts are thrown down randomly.
So, Vijan, you said you can't go below 1 unless there's some kind of repulsion.
Yes.
So, bursts, there's actually some...
There's a repulsion between each member of the burst. So that's where this comes from.
Okay.
When you get precise bursting, then you get a repulsion between them. That's why it's so sharp.
So when you throw a burst down, though, you have to throw them down with some repulsion.
That repulsion is reflected here. So
I thought that's interspike interval repulsion. I mean, that's refractory period.
There's two types of repulsion. There's the interburst repulsion and there's the intraburst and interburst repulsion. The intraburst, within a burst, you get two spikes arriving in a pair. They repel if which
refractory period
means that half the population, then you get this business.
Wait, refractory period associated with?
With
of individual spikes?
Of inside the bus, yeah. So there's a so that's the. So
earlier you showed refractory period giving you a roll off.
That was a different. That was no bursting in that plot. That was reflecting was when you had a between event, longer time scale, refractory period. So. Okay. And you see that here. You see that here. So at the low frequencies, you see it becoming more prominent. So without so bursting alone gives you something that looks like this. If you introduce repulsion between the bursts, you get this. And depending on your religion, you will at some point or another agree that there's a peak in the spectrum. I mean, you know, you can get a little tiny bump, or you can make it bigger and bigger, and eventually there's a peak. There's a huge controversy, I guess, about what constitutes a peak in the spectrum or oscillation. But I don't want to get into that because it's not that important. This is what it looks like. We can argue about what we think it is. The second observation. So this is the relation between the in-spike intervals and the spectrum. If they were arriving independently, these intervals, then you could just plot one on top of the other, and I can do that. What I want to emphasize is application of a different measure, the interval spectrum, that teaches you how the intervals are arriving. And so what does this interval spectrum look like? Well, this is the constant is what you get for a renewal process, and these error bars show that it deviates from what you'd expect for a renewal process in a very specific way. It deviates at a high inverse lag, inverse index. And what this means is that there's actually a correlation between one interval and the next interval. So it's high frequency. And so what you're getting is a high, low, high, low length of intervals between adjacent intervals. And so you can think of it as basically going from here to here to here to here, back and forth, more than you would get staying in the burst or staying in the other interval. And this is not something that you could get from the spectrum. This is a higher order correlation between the events, the spiking events, than you would see in the spectrum, but it's captured by the second order relationship between the intervals. And this is really where the interval spectrum and the spectrum play off one another, that in cases when the correlations, when there are higher order interactions between the events, you can characterize them in a simple way using a second order quantity. And that's important because higher order quantities are difficult to estimate with limited amounts of data. And this was estimated with only like 400 spikes.
I think I've understood what you've just said, except for the sign of the effect. You have said that this corresponds to essentially jumping from a doublet to a period with no spike, or
to an event which is a longer interval.
And I would have thought intuitively that this would be a decrease in this power in the interval spectrum.
So we can so this is now tau, the interval spike interval length, yeah. And this is the index.
Yeah.
So a doublet would be an event that's down here.
Yeah.
Something with a longer interval would be up here.
Yeah.
If we're going to go back, we're going to get something that's short again.
So typically you get a bunch of short ones and a bunch of long ones. A bunch of short ones represent a burst.
You get one short one and then one long one,
so
and then one short.
So consists of only two spikes?
Yes. One interspike interval.
Why?
Yeah,
so this has high frequency.
So I see.
Okay. So that's why it goes up here, and it's really not changing that much over the rest of the range of the function. It doesn't have to be like that. I mean, there's. So now I should move on.
Wait, PJ, you said that was not related to the bottom.
No, you cannot necessarily predict. So what you could have instead, is so this is reflecting of some. So if I take the marginal. Then the distribution of interval lengths will look like this. So this is now the ISI histogram on the vertical direction. I could reconstruct the process by drawing randomly from this ISI histogram. And it would have events which look like this, and then every now and then it would look like this. Okay. That gets rid of the correlations between the intervals. So the interval spectrum would be flat.
So that's telling you that the bursts are doublets and not like just bursts.
Or it says that, yeah, they arrive in doublets, and moreover, that when you have a long interspike interval, then you're more likely to get a short one following. For a renewal process, there is no such relationship between one interval and the next. And you can derive the spectrum from this, with uncorrelated intervals from the interspike interval histogram, but you can't when you have correlations between the intervals. The spectrum, unless you've defined some model which you then get the spectrum through for the correlations, and I can talk about that a little bit, but I'm never going to get to it. But this is the basic point.
So if you have a random number of spikes in each where it's completely random and independent of everything, then a random number, then you would not get everything.
Yes. In particular, what you would get is some distortion at low frequency.
If I'm talking about the interval spectrum.
Oh, yes, it would be flat.
It's like having a renewal process.
It's a renewal process, right.
Every next spike is determined independently, not every next spike.
Yeah. Okay. So this is, they come together. Bimodal ISIs, some high frequency interval spectrum, and some bump in the gamma band, in the spikes. And I can talk about the fields, so I should talk about the fields for a moment again, so just because it gives it a more sort of coherent story. Here's the other color picture. I hope it doesn't cause as much questioning as the last one. But basically what I want to say is this is the coherency plotted between the spikes and the fields. Let me show you the spike triggered average. That's probably a quicker way to do this. Here it is. So here's the spike triggered average between the spike triggered average in the baseline and in this memory condition. So in the baseline, remember, there's no gamma band activity. There's no bump in the spectrum at all. And if you take the field potential and trigger it off the events and the average, then you get basically this uprising before each spike. But you don't get any sort of longer time structure in this spike triggered average. When you do it in the memory period, when there's a lot of gamma band activity, you see quite a distinct oscillatory structure surrounding the event. And basically what's happening is the spikes are firing off some phase of the field potential in this gamma band. And you can... The error bars are error bars where you compare the function to what you would expect. There's no relationship between them at all in time. So when the mean is zero. The error bars are not very good error bars because you can see the structure is there. But these are time domain error bars and they're not suitable for capturing something which is localized in frequency. But
is this sine
right? So yes, this is an excellent point. We flipped all of the field potentials to be upward going spikes rather than downward going spikes. That was also present in the first signal. It's an aesthetic issue that was executively decided. Anyway, so that's what the function looks like. I don't want to... the coherency, right? So here's a bump in some frequency band, and it's not really there at other frequency. I mean, and there's the significance level. And basically, in the gamma band, you get a bump, a significant correlation between the spikes, and the fields is not there at the other frequencies in the memory condition, but not during baseline. And there's all kinds of issues that we can talk about, but that's the basic point, is that you've got this structure in the spike train which results in a bump in the spectrum that is related to some correlation between intervals of bursting and not bursting that's correlated with a oscillation in the field potential. And then we can argue about whether or not the spike train is oscillating. But regardless of whether or not you think that the bursting is an oscillation, it's certainly correlated with an oscillation.
Concerning the question whether there is an oscillation or not, you could just draw the consequence out of your interval distribution. So you would get a spectrum from that. If it still contains the bump in this frequency, it's certainly just a renewal process with certain intervals.
This is an interesting game that you can play. It basically boils down to how convinced are you that there's an oscillation? What is the Q factor? The question is, the statement really is, wasn't really a question.
My statement is, if it's a renewal process, it's not an oscillation. Because an
that is not true. I can have an oscillation in a renewal process.
If it's a sharp...
It's all about the sharpness of your peak.
What
I mean,
is the sense of the what is the meaning of the word oscillation?
Exactly.
There's something more than just from one interval to the next. So if you can explain...
You may think so.
Look,
I mean... Okay, look. I don't want to get totally bogged down in this because I've only got 50...
I mean,
Why
don't
discuss it later in limbo?
Okay. Well, no, but this is I've actually cried over this for many months and gotten nowhere. So I would like to get somewhere. So if I've got something which is coming every few milliseconds, let's say, right, and the jitter in that distribution is relatively narrow, it can still be a renewal process, but
yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of statement is how you can say it's not oscillating, because there is definitely some periodicity, and if you take the spectrum of such a thing, it will have a great big peak in it. Okay.
But not the interval spectrum.
The interval spectrum will not have a peak. The interval spectrum does not explicitly test for oscillations. It just makes it just tests for whether or not the history of the spike train is longer range.
Mm-hmm.
Things get more complicated if you throw bursts in there, okay? Because then what happens is that this timing does not need to be so precise for you to get quite nice big bumps in the spectrum, but you also get something else at higher frequency, the bursting frequency, okay? So it is true that a cell which is firing bursts does not have to have very precise control over the arrival times of the other spikes to get a spectrum with a bump in it. It's a more noisy oscillation, you could say, because instead of having one spike in a phase of the oscillation, you get two. And that just inherently reduces the signal, increases the signal to noise, it makes it less. So, and the other spikes can then be more noisy. Okay, but you can have a renewal process which oscillates. I guess
what distinguishes it from real oscillations in some sense, if you look at the jitter,
accumulates. Well,
have a renewal process, and if you have a real oscillation, you would like it somehow to be corrected.
Absolutely, and it's
the face. Here you cannot really.
You don't see this in the brain. You don't see, at least you don't see it in cortex. You do see it in other structures.
Don't see what?
You do not see. Narrow. So this is what Wyeth Besh studied in detail. You do not see oscillations in spike trains which are characterized by low variance jitter in some underlying fundamental period. You don't see that.
And so you don't see real oscillations in the brain. Only renewal process.
But take that back. No. You can't. Wait a second. Think about what you just said. You said the oscillation should have some longer term history which corrects for itself.
Right.
That's what this is doing. And I'll convince you of this even more so.
You do see it, okay.
Well, I'm not going to give you some functional. I mean, yes, you do see it, I would say, because you're seeing some correction. When the interval gets long, it then throws down a short interval. And we'll go even further. I'll show you in the reaching area. It's quite pronounced, and it has a different kind of structure. But let's move on. Okay, so the Poisson process is ruled out. The renewal process is ruled out. Let's model this. How do we model it? It'd be nice to incorporate the LFP observations, which show some clock, you could say. I mean, it's a noisy clock. Let's not get carried away. But it's certainly local in frequency. No. I don't want to stop any questions.
Since you say clock, what is the dephasing time of the field oscillator, of the gamma field oscillator? There's a coherence time.
Yeah. It's about 100 milliseconds. You can see that in here. Right, so you're getting this wiggle, but it's not, it's definitely localized. It's quite, the really pronounced effect is around 20, 30 milliseconds. Right, but then it's still present out to 100 milliseconds.
It looks like it's keep going. I mean, there's no.
That's a pretty good oscillation.
It's a pretty good oscillation. It's very long. It's actually. It's only not significant because the measure is terrible, right?
Yeah, yes. Okay,
so let me show you the significant measure. Okay, this shows you the significant measure. So I'm only showing the phase. So this is a complex number. It has an amplitude in the phase. The amplitude, you can write down what the distribution of the amplitude you expect when it's not correlation between the two processes. When it's 99% exceeding that confidence interval, I show you the phase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the phase is organized and basically slightly negative over the whole memory period for over a second through the saccade. So its dephasing time is very long.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to if you want to look at it from the point of view of the spikes.
This is spikes relative to the field potential.
You can also get the field potential from the spikes. An interesting experiment to do is have the monkey sit there for 5 seconds and see how long you can maintain the phase of this oscillation. It's difficult to get monkeys.
The difference between the spike and local field potential.
Instantaneous,
right? Yeah, phase relationship between spikes and local field potential.
Doesn't mean that your clock went on.
Why not?
Because the frequency, the phase of the field potential can be changing, right?
The phase of the fill potential can be changing, yes. This is why So the spikes track the changing phase of the fill potential for long periods of time. The fill potential itself has a phase, but the only way I can measure the changing phase of the fill potential is by taking another recording of the fill potential somewhere else. And measure, I mean, you need to measure variations in phase somehow.
You see how long the ringing lasts.
Yeah, I could also do it. I could do that.
Fred just wants to know what's the length of the correlation for the ringing.
So I'm saying about 100 milliseconds.
So Bija, doesn't the field potential have to track the spikes? Is the field potential caused by the spikes?
We don't exactly know the relationship between the spikes and the fields.
No, we don't. Is that a general statement?
We don't. Because, for example, there's all the structure and low frequencies in the field potential at 20 hertz, which are not related to spikes. So what is that all about?
You're asking us.
I have no idea.
It's a funny situation.
I've only done one study.
But it is true that spikes cause field potential, right?
Electrical activity causes the field potential. It could be the synaptic activity that leads to the spike, which is in the field potential, and then the events are. There is some non-specific relationship between the two.
But from the time order, the local field potential first goes down and then the spikes.
So the spikes fire off the negativity in your definition.
Your positivity.
Yes. Off the leading edge. So the phase of the field potential peak, the oscillation of the field potential peak is after the spike. Right, so the spike fires off the leading edge of the, in my definition, I mean, I can draw it up, you know. I mean, but you see the point, you see what I'm trying to say. Pardon? Sorry,
Both synaptic activity and spikes contribute to the field potential, and the spikes contribute more to the high frequency part.
Oh, absolutely. No, yes. But the field potential, local field potential is usually defined as being less than a couple hundred hertz at most. The spikes certainly contribute to all of the hash, the really high frequency stuff.
Relative to the synaptic
activity. There is going to be some spiking influence on the size of the signal at low frequencies, this ripple, this low frequency ripple. But it's going to be very small compared to what you would expect from currents and synapses. Because the action potential is another large current event.
So now the currents are associated with spikes
somewhere. Other spikes somewhere else. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it's all due to spiking in the end, I think. I'm not clear. I mean, I don't know. So the models, though. So
when you say Poisson process rule out, you mean Poisson process including other continuous?
Absolutely, because of this repulsion between events.
There is a repulsion.
You're just calling it a renewal process.
So Poisson process.
Well, a renewal process is uncorrelated by its definition. We can extend the renewal process, which is what I want to do now. So we can throw in correlations. That's still not going to work because you need to get, for these types of processes, because you need to have bursting. So it makes it more complicated because an homogeneous Poisson process with a refractory period, where's the spectrum?
Well, bursting is just upswing in the range.
Then you, when are you going to throw the rate up? It becomes, it's got to be a,
it has to be a renewal between bursts, not just spikes.
Yeah, exactly. If you were to increase the rate of the Poisson process to hit the bursts, you still need to throw the rate up in an organized fashion so that you get the low frequency suppression. Just to reiterate, when you increase the rate of a Poisson process, you increase the level of the spectrum above one always. You never push it down anywhere else. So what you want to do is push it down at low frequencies by throwing in a refractory period. That's fine. I mean, we can do that. I'm not quite sure where this refractory period came from, but it's there. So it's allow you to hand build it in. Now you want to put another refractory. You need to now build another refractory period between the pairs of spikes in the bus to hit this other suppression below one. It becomes a very complicated game, and it misses the point, is what I would say. The point is that cells do not fire spikes at all like a Poisson process. when they, the closest they get is this refractory period, which still is not explained. And in these cells with gamma band peaks, it's not that the firing rate is varying in gamma band or anything like that at all. It's different. I don't really know what it is. I think it has something to do with one of these other two suggestions, which I wanted to make, which is that either we've got some kind of renewal process which is switching between states, so some kind of, that's how you can build in a longer term dependency between the intervals, is by having, you know, Markovian state transitions. And the simplest thing to do is have two states with a transition matrix that has, you know, so here's my two states. I have an interburst interval, which has got some distribution of interspike intervals, which is very short time, down, it falls off very quickly with high rate. And then I have another one, which is the interburst interval. So I switch between these, so I have a spike here, and then I get another spike quickly or another spike slowly. And I have these two different states, and I can be in state one or state two, and stay in state one or state two with some probability P1 or P2, and I can have transitions between those states, which is obviously 1 minus P1 because it's got to be a probability, and I can have a cell which just switches between these two different states. And there are cells which have been characterized with these kinds of biophysics by McCormick's, in McCormick's lab, and their idea is that this is this so-called chattering where you get da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And these cells chatter when you have constant current input, so you just depolarize the cell, and it tends to fire spikes quickly, and then it has some longer time, and then it fires another burst. So this is one way of extending the Markov renewal process, and it does fit some of the data. You can do analytics on this, you can do interval spectra and spectrum and so forth. But there's a different kind of extension to the renewal process. It's a kind of a special kind of cell that does that. It doesn't need to be so a detailed fit. Another way you could do it is you could just have an integrated fine neuron which doesn't have white noise inputs. You can throw correlations in the inputs. Temporal correlations, right. So you can have a simple cellular mechanism instead of a complicated cellular mechanism, and you can still get correlations in the intervals that will result from this extrinsic process. There's some feed, some drive to the neuron, which is not push. It's push-pull, push-pull. It's coming on and off. And that may allow you to integrate observations in the field potential.
Which you're about to have if your populations
This is where function comes in, but yeah, maybe this allows.
Same, you can take LFP and put it as an input to the integrated file.
Some part of the LFP, yeah.
Get the spikes out and this input system.
Yeah, you can do that. Absolutely. So these are sort of simple extensions to, you can get sort of carried away with this. But these are the two basic classes. There's a complicated cellular mechanism with a constant input with some switching between states, which gives you this chattering, or a simple cellular mechanism with a more sort of with correlated inputs, so where the complexity is now in the network, not in the cell. It's obviously going to be some combination of the two, right? So you've got these cells which tend to chatter, right? Because these have been shown to exist, and they tend to do it, they do it very easily. And they then maybe recruit other cells to do it, perhaps, which results in now a population of cells doing it. Or maybe they just involve, they're just working independently, but they happen to do it a lot. And they're sending lots of bursts in this sort of timed fashion. And then that drives other populations of cells. Okay, so let's quickly go to the other, because I want to show you the stuff from the reach region. But the basic question was, people have calculated, estimated the spectrum and reported bursting in MT. They've seen the same thing in PRR. They haven't really analyzed the bursting. I guess that's what I'm doing here. And the question I had was, are correlations also present between those intervals, or is it just some renewal process and it's something funny about LIP, perhaps? So this is MT. So there's not all cells do this. A lot of cells do this. They just have some big suppression and no bursting and flat interval spectra. So this is, your nice refractory cell. I should emphasize that I argue with the description of refractoriness unless you have an interval spectrum that's flat. You can't assign features to the spectrum, i.e. dips at some frequency or whatever, to a refractory period unless you've shown that there are no dependencies beyond the refractory period, because those dependencies would also change the spectrum. But this is a flat
period. Refractory period should not depend on the rate. It should be like 3 milliseconds, but not 3 milliseconds or 5 or 6.
Well, these are not biphysical refractory periods. These are relative refractory periods, so they tend not to fire within 20 milliseconds of each other or 30 milliseconds. Okay. So these may well be network effects. Okay. Who knows, really? But they're not likely to be network effects because the interval spectrum is constant, and so therefore the cell could just be integrating these white noise inputs. and resetting each time. So here's another cell. This is a bursting. You don't see this so much in LIP, but you see it a lot in MT. And basically, you just get a lot of spikes in these bursts, very sharp, and then you get some roll-off, but there's no real bump in the other part of the RSI. And if you look at the spectrum, you don't see it coming down at low frequencies. It comes up to some DC level. And there's no peak. There's no gamma. I mean, it's just bursting. And it's this cosine squared shape, basically, for a bursting cell. But you still see correlations between the intervals. And this is widely present in bursting cells. So it tells...
Eventually that comes down, right?
It ripples. Because your burst...
To the left, 0 hertz.
Really, really high frequencies. Well, I can't tell you for this data because it's only sample.
0 hertz.
No. So it goes up. It hits...
Even though there's a refractive period?
This is the whole point. The refractive period isn't such a big deal. It doesn't really explain that much in the spectrum. Is my statement. The bursting here is really dominating any other... You can't see the refractory period.
So earlier I thought anytime you get a refractory period in low frequency...
Oh, you mean the biophysical effect, the very short time.
Yeah, the very short time.
Yeah, that hardly ever has an effect on the spectrum. The biophysical refractory period can only be seen when the firing rate is like 300 hertz, like over the whole window. You're not going to see 1 millisecond timescale effects on the spectrum without having a lot of spikes. If you've only got 50 hertz, you're not going to see the biophysical refraction period. But there are cells that have these multimodal ISIs in MT, and I call it chattering just for simplicity, and they have nice bumps in their spectra, and they have very non-white interval spectra. And if you want to look across the population, we see, I just divided out, so I sorted the interval spectra as to whether or not they were basically around 1, if not significantly different from 1 at a 95% level, significantly positive slope or negative slope. So half the cells look like this, about another 40% of cells look like this, and 10% of cells look like this. And this is across a database. It's a huge database. It's a great data set. It's like 240 cells in 4 monkeys. And lots of trials, and it's perfectly designed for analyzing this kind of activity. And if you look at the spectrum, so then if I take all the cells with this interval spectrum and just average the spectrum, you see that they actually divide out quite nicely too. So the blue line shows you the average spectrum from these cells. And they're basically characterized by this bursting with some spectral peak. And then you've also got refractory sort of suppressions. So this is across the database. So, yeah.
It looks like we've kicked out. Maybe you can finish this.
Yeah, let me just show you this last thing. So let's see PRR. So this is very simple. Very simple. So the reach region is not the same. It's very similar, but it's not the same. And I thought it's different in an interesting way. So this is what the ISI looks like for your average reach cell. Reach area cell. It's got a lot of bursts, right? But these bursts are not very precise. There's no sharp peak. We've got bursts below 5 milliseconds, but there's this long tail, and it's distinctly different from the bimodal ISIs that we see in the other brain areas. The spectrum is not the same either. But it does have a really, really big peak. This is a huge peak. The other figures I'm showing you are up to 1.5. The size of this peak is more than 2 times as large, and it's at a lower frequency. It's at around 25 hertz. The other peaks are around 50 hertz. The other point is that since the bursts aren't very precise, you don't get this other uprising at high frequencies. It's basically like suppressed below the line a little bit, but it's distributed over all frequencies. So really, this is what you would call a simple peak in the spectrum. What does the ISI histogram look like? The ISI, the interval spectrum look like. The interval spectrum has a bump at not 0.5, or the peak at not 0.5, but around 0.3, which is 1 over 3. So what's happening in the reach region? What you're seeing is that the firing rate is high. There's a lot of spikes that arrive very close together. The spectrum has a peak of 25 hertz. So you've got a firing rate of like 60, 70, 80 hertz, a lot of these cells. But your peak in the spectrum is at a much lower frequency. So what the cell is doing to generate this large number of spikes with some periodicity that's at a lower frequency is it's throwing down multiple spikes per period of the oscillation. It throws down 3 spikes. And that's why you're getting a triplets with very few doublets. if you were to have only doublets, predominantly doublets, your firing rate would not get above 30, 40, you know, maximum 50 hertz. While to get these high firing rates, because their firing rates are not significantly different from what you find in LIP and MT, these cells fire just as strongly. They just happen to fire with a lower frequency. And so this is the principal difference. MT shows similar temporal structure that's in LIP. The peak is at a relatively high frequency, 50 hertz, and there's lots of doublets. The interval spectrum has a peak at a half. While a PRR has a much lower frequency spectral peak, is significantly lower, but it still contains bursting. It's still bursting. And the bursts just happen to, the spikes happen to arrive in triplets rather than doublets. And let me just show you a couple of spike trains. So this is what the reach region looks like. It's a different cell than the one I just showed you, but basically it's oscillating in triplets, while in the other areas it's oscillating in doublets. So I think that if we're going to sort of, you know, it'd be nice to integrate this activity, because the LIP, PRR, whatever, you know, these other brain areas, they're not so far away from each other. They're all cortex. The fraction of cells that do this is around 40%. In one monkey, we've got 70% of cells they recorded has this kind of structure in it. So it's very, very significant, and it may play an important functional role. These structures are spatially tuned, as I showed you in LIP. They're tuned to the memory period. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. It's just more subtle and complicated than you might hope for an oscillation.
Maybe it has to do with the fact that leaching occurs on a longer time scale.
That might be the case, but I don't think so, because this oscillation is when the fire is in a period when the animal's preparing. So it's not related to movement specifically.
So, excuse me, our seminar is supposed to have begun 5 minutes ago.
That's right, let's continue the lines.